Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Take a minute to get set. I'll just go ahead and introduce the next case. A23-1360, Diane Mullis versus Professional Plating. Counsel, we'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. And as you know, counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium is adjustable, so please feel free to adjust it if need be. You'll see a clock on the podium as well. Hopefully I pronounced appellant's name properly, but if not, please correct me, counsel for appellant, when you introduce yourself, so you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chris Moreland. I'm here today along with my partner, Ross Stadheim, and our client, Dan Mullis, to respectfully request that this court reverse an order of the Anoka County District Court granting summary judgment to Ms. Mullis' former employer, ProPlate, and dismissing her MHRA reprisal claim. As set forth in our briefs and as we'll talk about in further detail here today, the district court held that in the absence of proof that ProPlate subjected Ms. Mullis' colleague, Israel Hassan, to legally actionable discrimination, including an adverse employment action, Ms. Mullis could not state a viable MHRA reprisal claim based on her objection to discriminatory conduct directed at Mr. Hassan by ProPlate President Craig Ingalls. There is no dispute, I think, as the court is aware from having reviewed the briefs, that Mr. Ingalls made the statement attributed to him, i.e., in the presence of an interviewee. He introduced Mr. Hassan after giving Mr. Hassan's colleague, Mercedes Anderson, the respect of using her name in the introduction. He introduced Mr. Hassan as our black Jewish Muslim employee, did not use his name. He later called it a joke, but there is no dispute that is what is said.
Counsel, the district court suggests that there is some dispute over what was actually said. In the footnote, it says that Mr. Hassan had a different memory of what was said.
He did not testify any differently in terms of what the substance of it was. He may have had a difference with the order of the words, but there is no dispute as to the not moniker, Jewish, black Jewish Muslim employee. And in fact, Mr. Hassan testified that is something, or at least Mr. Ingalls testified that is something that he considered to be a joke between him and Mr. Hassan that he used on several occasions. So in terms of the actual words used and the lack of using Mr. Hassan's name and referring to him simply by race and religion. And by the way, Mr. Hassan is neither Jewish nor Muslim, which I think is an important factor. But there is no dispute as to that being the words used, and I don't think counsel for respondent will argue any differently in his presentation.
Well, there's no dispute that ethnicity and religion were mentioned, but one could argue that the language used, according to Mr. Hassan, was slightly different.
One could argue that, but on summary judgment, the facts as alleged by the plaintiff as and supported in the record have to be viewed in the light most favorable to us and given us all inferences in our favor. And so to the extent that there is a dispute, it's not a material dispute. I think that counsel for respondent will acknowledge that those were the words and that they were racially and religiously descriptive as opposed to using the person's name.
Right. I had a similar question to Judge Cleary, and I was looking at page 7 of respondent's brief where Mr. Hassan testified that it was more than just those three words, that I have a Muslim last name and a Western middle name and Judaism associated with my first name. So that's a different version, I think.
Well, it's not a different version of what was said. It's an explanation of why it was said, right? That was not...
That was not testimony about what was actually spoken.
Correct. I'm sorry if that
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt here, but that's not what the footnote says. It says that he testified that he was introduced as, and then his name, and goes on to say Judge Johnson just went
He was introduced to Mr. Kuplik as ProPlate's black Jewish Muslim employee. In his deposition, he explained where that came from and why he was why that was used. He didn't say that anybody in the context of the introduction, and Ms. Mullis, in responding to it and objecting to it, heard his explanation. He says that's why sometimes Mr. Ingalls calls me this. So contextually, I guess it provides information as to his opinion as to why it was used, but he didn't explain that to anybody in the context of the introduction that was made and the conduct to which Ms. Mullis objected.
Okay, but I don't want to beat this into the ground. The footnote says that his testimony was that he was introduced as, and then goes on to give this other version. So it isn't like this is the background. You're saying this is what he said.
Everybody else testified that this is what he said. And so if there's a dispute of fact, then I guess that's something for the trial court to decide on remand. And I don't mean to be flip about it.
No, I understand.
Okay. So I think as we get back to the important, or I'm sorry, not the important part, but as we get back to what the district court did here, I think the key point to note is that in terms of what the district court held relative to reprisal plaintiffs, the district court imposed a differential dichotomous evidentiary burden depending on who the recipient of the discrimination is. And I certainly don't want to stand up and read to you, but it's important, I think, for the context of the discussion. And so what the district court said in granting summary judgment is that, quote, a reprisal claim for reporting discrimination against someone other than the plaintiff operates logically differently than a reprisal claim for reporting an incident against the plaintiff, end quote. The district court went on to say, quote, because Mullis was not the target of the prohibited conduct, i.e. the racially motivated introduction, it is logically reasonable to require Mullis to anchor her allegation of, her allegation and report on more solid and observable employment actions, end quote. And so what the district court is saying is that if you're not the personal subject of the discrimination, in order to state a reprisal claim, you have to meet a higher evidentiary burden than you would have if you were the target. And there's no precedent for that in the language of the MHRA, which certainly doesn't say, you know, if you're objecting to discrimination against a colleague, you have to make this evidentiary showing. If you're objecting to evidentiary, or if you're objecting to discrimination levied at yourself, you have to make this evidentiary showing. And I think that's consistent with what this court has done in cases that post-date Barr, and that's Delaney v. Cragen Court, most notably, which we can talk about. But ultimately, the district court then went on to say, in light of the Barr decision, Barr v. Capella University, because Mr. Hassan, was not subjected to an adverse employment action, Ms. Mullis could not have a reasonable good faith belief that prohibited discrimination had occurred and thus could not state a viable reprisal claim. So because Barr is the, you know, focus and impetus for respondents' motion and the sole basis for the district court's decision, I think we need to look at Barr. And our position is that it does not sweep nearly as broadly as the district court interpreted it, A, and B, even under the most restrictive interpretation of Barr, even if you apply an actual violation standard to Ms. Mullis's report, she gets there under the law as it exists in Minnesota. And again, evidence.
So what evidence shows that she had, you know, in Barr they talk about both a subjective and objective reasonable good faith or reasonable belief.
Right.
And so what evidence shows that she had a good faith belief that was objectively reasonable, that her employer had engaged in a practice forbidden by 08?
Sure.
That part of the Human Rights
Assuming
Act.
That is... You know, assuming that it is required that they show that that actually happened, that he was subjected to actual discrimination, which is not the law, but the objective evidence
but,
that...
But I'm there sorry. Has to be, I mean, it has to be connected substantively to the law, I
of
think
course.
Is what Barr says,
yep.
right?
And that's kind of the...
And so I don't think, I agree, I think I agree with you that Barr doesn't require showing of an adverse employment action. But there has to be a showing that it's at least objectively reasonable.
It does.
And so what is that showing?
Sure. And the showing that it is objectively reasonable, that she had a good faith belief that this is racially and religiously discriminatory, is the fact that every witness who testified and the testimony is cited in our brief agreed and thought that it was also racially and religiously discriminatory. Even Mr. Hassan, I keep saying his name wrong and I apologize. Even Mr. Hassan, who, you know, they focus on the fact that he said he wasn't offended, ultimately there's a disputed question of fact there because people witnessed him, you know, feeling, looking down and appearing embarrassed, and they talked to him afterwards, and he said, you know, Mr. Engels thinks this is okay to say, but it's really not. I'm not going to say anything because I fear retaliation. And so, but back to the question, which is what is the objective evidence of discrimination, is the fact that everybody who testified said, yeah, I see and understand, well, Mercedes Anderson, the coworker, and Ms. Mullis, of course, said, yes, this is, they described it as discriminatory. So they certainly believe
that.
But
simply being discriminatory isn't enough. Would you agree with that? I mean, discrimination can have all sorts of meanings. So doesn't it have to be tethered somehow, according to the Barr case, substantively to the Minnesota Human Rights Act?
It does, Your Honor. It has to be substantively connected to the law, right? It can't just be based on an individual's own personal belief. So, for example, if I believe that it's discriminatory to take action against somebody because they have blue eyes, that is certainly on the face of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, not something that would be, forbidden, right? And so, but this isn't that case. And I think, so the evidence that it's a good faith belief is that other people believed it and understood it. And then also it is tied, and we talk about this in the briefs as well, is it is intricately and intimately tied to what discrimination is as defined under the MHRA, which includes, you know, segregation, separation, decision-making and comments based on what the Supreme Court in City of Minneapolis versus Richardson called irrelevant details such as race, such as religion. As evidenced by the fact that in other cases, the courts have held that, you know, comments such as this that are particularly in the context of Title VII, that racial comments issued by a supervisor are sufficient to meet the prima facie case of a reprisal plaintiff because they are the type of discriminatory comments that are historically forbidden by these remedial acts. And so it is tied to the terms and conditions of and privileges of Mr. Hassan's employment because, and this is another issue that the district court kind of punted on and didn't address, and we made the argument that this does constitute, you know, at least a fact question with respect to whether he did suffer an adverse action, which is...
So, is in that regard, is the Henry case, the Supreme Court's Henry case, relevant? That was a 2023 case, Human Rights Act case, and neither party cited it. It discusses, among other issues, you know, what a hostile work environment claim in addition to a disparate treatment claim.
For purposes here, I suppose Henry is, I guess, maybe instructive, but I think that within the context of what the district court did and what everybody kind of looks at as the end-all be-all right now, which I guess is Barr in terms of the overarching analysis of the MHRA, you know, Henry doesn't also get into what the argument we've made, which is what are the specific terms and conditions of employment and how do those play into, you know, the workplace and what constitutes discrimination.
So you're not arguing that this introduction is evidence of a hostile work environment?
I think we would have a tough row to hoe there because it was, you know, this instance in one isolated context, although I think it does, again, get right into the wheelhouse of what is the terms and privileges and conditions of employment. And I think it is not a stretch to suggest that basic human dignity being referred to as by your name or perhaps by your job title after your colleague who is standing right next to you was given that same respect and dignity, right? And so the United States Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have made it clear that, you know, the concept of adverse employment actions is not limited to economic or tangible discrimination. The United States Supreme Court has spoken broadly and calls this, it's very expansive. It's intended to outlaw discrimination in all of its forms across the spectrum. And so I think, again, given that the basic question of whether an adverse employment action has occurred is generally a question of fact, Not only did the court misapply the law, it overstepped its, the district court overstepped its bounds and decided fact questions as a matter of law and erred in that respect as well.
No, go ahead.
Well, I guess, so I'm not following you exactly. What, so, I mean, let's go to this, specifically the district court's reasoning. There was no adverse employment action. What would you say is the adverse employment action?
The adverse employment action, to the extent one that is required, to the extent that we have to show the existence of something that would be actionable by Mr. Hussein.
What was it?
Which is that? I mean, if you have an adverse employment action, he would have an...
No, I mean, yeah, okay. I'm asking you, what is it?
Yeah, what is it?
Get to the point, please.
Yeah, sorry. Well, the adverse employment action is being denigrated, reduced, and referred to only by his race or religious, his observable characteristics, not by his name, not by his job title, not by his qualifications.
But you're saying, but you're disavowing a hostile environment claim?
We're talking about this in the context of one instance, right? And so if you're talking about a hostile work environment, I think that there is a basis for a claim that the environment is hostile too. However, that's not what the district court made its decision based on, and so that wasn't a focus of our discussion.
But I guess discrimination is defined under the statute. I'm looking for the definition, but it requires some, well, I'm looking at point 08, I guess. It talks about just... I guess how do you find? I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Discriminate against a person with respect to hiring, tenure, compensation, terms, upgrading, conditions, facilities, or privileges of employment. I mean, what evidence is there that Mr. Hassan suffered in any of those ways, and that she knew it at the time that she made her report?
I notice my time is up. Can I respond?
Yes, you may.
Okay,
sorry,
you so
I was
no.
reading part of the bear. Bear or bar? How do you pronounce
it? Bar.
Bar.
Yeah,
okay,
bar,
thank
B-A-H-R.
You.
B-A-H-R. Excellent question, of course. So the term discriminate is defined in the statute elsewhere as well, as I'm sure Your Honor is aware, 363A.13, and that includes segregate and separate. The Minnesota Supreme Court has further interpreted that to encompass racial comments that are based simply on a person's race, and so that's kind of that comes into play as well. But in terms of the term, the privileges and conditions of employment, again, you know, the argument here, and this is recognized in Title VII cases, which of course the MHRA is interpreted the same, the standards are the same, and in fact the reprisal provision of MHRA is more broadly worded and is supposed to be more protective than the federal standard. But under the federal standard, the terms and conditions of employment are broad and sweeping and include, our argument is, the notion of personal dignity, personal identity, not being reduced by your boss to somebody who is simply of another race or another religion. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Well, that sounds like, I mean... It sounds like it fits not so much into the statutory phrase that I was reading, 0.08 sub 2.3, but it sounds like concepts that are incorporated into the law about hostile work environment, harassment, and so on.
Well, not necessarily specifically to that, but in the context of what constitutes discrimination in terms of privileges, conditions, and terms of employment. And so the cases that we've cited and are discussing, like, for example, DeLady, that's not a hostile work environment claim. It was an incident of reporting, you know, sexual harassment against a particular individual. It didn't rise to the level of being actionable, but she nevertheless had a reprisal claim, even though she had not suffered or been subjected to conduct that actually violated the MHRA. And I know I'm really over time, so I don't mean to be...
Well, I'm still struggling to understand your theory and whether you're... I mean, I think under the MHRA, there could be a... You know, I mean, Henry, for example, talked about a hostile work environment claim and a disparate impact claim. And the disparate impact type of claim is... Or the case law is more clear about adverse employment action is a requirement.
Sure.
And when it comes to hostile work environment and harassment... You alluded to the requirements, severe and pervasive, and so on. But so I'm kind of asking you, which is it here? I mean, if there was a practice that's prohibited by the MHRA, what type of practice was it that what type of prohibited practice was engaged in? Was it the disparate treatment or was it
disparate treatment.
Hostile
disparate treatment as evidenced by that particular incident.
And the adverse employment action, then, I guess you're saying is a loss of dignity.
Correct.
And is there any case law recognizing that as an adverse employment action in a disparate treatment type of claim?
There is not specifically, nor is there case law requiring the adverse action. And again, under Title VII and the MHRA as applied through the Title VII, it's clear under the law in Title VII that you can be mistaken, the plaintiff can be mistaken about whether or not, you know, a discrimination has occurred and thus whether or not there was an adverse action and still state a viable reprisal claim under Title VII. Same under the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, which we could talk about, as which I might on rebuttal, but again, I know I'm really not trying to be, maybe we're talking past each other, but I think the law is pretty clear in terms of what Ms. Mullis needed to show just to get by summary judgment, and that under any iteration of the test, she did that, and the district court.
Well, here's something for you to think about on rebuttal. I think Bayer says, with regard to disparate treatment, there must be some material employment disadvantage. Minor changes in working conditions are insufficient. So I'd like you to address why, if this is, you know, a change in the working conditions or terms, why it's not just minor, why it's a material employment disadvantage.
Yep, happy to do so.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Counsel for respondent, thank you for your patience.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Nick Clare. I represent Professional Plating Incorporated in this matter, the respondent. What this case is about is how does a Minnesota court analyze a reprisal claim, which is for discrimination and religion, under Barr, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in Barr, where a reporting party is not the person that is being discriminated against, but reporting for another party or another employee. Under the standard of Barr, the Minnesota Supreme Court case that deals with this exact situation, the district court's order and its decision was right. So the facts in Barr are similar to the facts here. We have a woman who indicates that another employee who is African-American is being discriminated against, or she feels that she's being discriminated against. And that individual then, that woman individual gets terminated. Similar type of instance here. What the Barr court did is the Barr court stated that you have to analyze it in a certain way that's different than a direct action type of a case. And it's interesting to note, when you look at the Barr decision, what the appellants are requesting this court do is exactly what the Minnesota Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals on. Because the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court reversed, they said, the Court of Appeals had said, the appellant in that case that under the reprisal statute only needs to allege facts supporting a good faith, reasonable belief that the conduct constituted a violation of the MHRA. And that's what we have here. We have the appellant saying, I believe it, and I think other people might believe it. But what the court in Barr said, the Supreme Court said, is you have to have two standards in this type of a case. There's the subjective standard that Ms. Mullis, the appellant in this case, has, but there has to be an objective standard. And what the district court did in following Barr is Barr had stated that the objective portion has to be somehow anchored in substantive law. And so how did the Supreme Court in Barr then analyze this type of a situation? So the first thing they did was they looked at Minnesota Statute 363A.08, Subdivision 2.3, where it states unfair employment practice. It's an unfair employment practice for an employer because of race or religion to discriminate against a person with respect to hiring, tenure, compensation, terms, upgrading conditions, facilities, or privileges of employment. So that's how the court and bar begins to analyze the case. They then state they looked at, as was discussed here, the discrimination definition under 363A03, subdivision 13. And they understood that the discrimination had to be tied in with the actual statute itself. And what's interesting about that is the district court specifically in its order and on page 18 of its order stated that the word discriminate does not appear in the statute in isolation. Rather, discrimination must be associated with, in an employment case, hiring, tenure, compensation, terms, upgrading, conditions, facilities, or privileges of employment. The bar court then stated, and this is on page 83 of the bar decision, a cursory reading of the MHRA indicates that in order for there to be discrimination that constitutes unlawful employment practice, there must be some employment, adverse employment action.
That's true, but then we have Henry, which, you know, postdates Barr and talks about that you can also have a hostile work environment claim.
And I think that you're right on that, Judge.
So, but here it sounds like they're not making that argument and we're looking at a disparate treatment claim. And then in Barr, the Supreme Court goes on to say there must be some material employment disadvantage. Minor changes in working conditions are insufficient.
That's correct.
And I'm sure you were about to get to this, but can you address appellant's argument that this was a change in working conditions that wasn't minor?
I can.
Or that this statement in effect, or introduction in effect, as I understand the argument, had discriminated with regard to working conditions.
There's no evidence here that there was any working condition that was altered in any way. It's not a work harassment, a hostile environment type of a situation, nor was it ever claimed to be. It was on the basis of, I believe that this individual, Mr. Hassan, was discriminated, and I don't like that, and then she was terminated. So what happens is, under Henry, It's an entirely different way to look at it, because Henry did not overrule Barr, which is the situation where another individual is reporting discrimination on race or on gender or as to the religious effect. And Barr comes back and says, under those circumstances, like you had indicated, Judge Cochran, that there has to be some adverse employment action. There's no evidence that the conditions of Mr. Hassan changed. It's in the record that he continues to be employed, that he has actually been promoted, he has been given more responsibilities, he has received more compensation. There is nothing in the record to indicate that there was any treatment, whether it be that he felt better or not, there's no evidence that there was an adverse employment action to his employment itself. And the interesting thing about that is in Barr, which sets forth the standard regarding how to analyze this, the McCoy, and I understand it's an unpublished decision, but this court specifically followed Barr in that situation. And the McCoy fact situation is similar to Barr and is similar to this situation. In McCoy, you have a male individual who is an employee. He made or believed that two women were being discriminated against on the basis of their gender. And he made that discrimination known to his employer. And after that, after some period of time, he was terminated. And he brought a reprisal claim, just as the appellant did in this case, saying, I was terminated due to the fact that I made a reporting of discrimination for these two other female individuals. The Barr court, or the McCoy court, followed Barr in that analysis. And what the McCoy court indicated was that they looked again at the subdivisions of the MHRA, and they stated that plaintiff must make a showing, as in Barr, that the two women were subjected to some adverse employment action, such as reduction in pay, change in duties, working conditions, etc. So the court followed Barr and found that it had to be somehow the subjective and objective, that objective standard had to be had to anchor the reasoning of the person having a good faith belief. And both Barr and the McCoy court and the district court in this case state that's logical. Because if you have a situation where you have your own personal belief that there's a discriminatory action, and it may not be discrimination under the law, but if you have your own belief of that and you're reporting it for somebody else, and that other person never has any disparate treatment such as a demotion, moved from their desk, put somewhere different, something that would be more than a minor type of employment change, that the person making that reporting of discrimination can't tie that to anything. And basically,
Mr.
what
Clare,
the yes,
I think I understand the point you're making. In your addendum, page one of your addendum, you included an email that plaintiff sent to herself on January 14. What's the relevance of that? How does that fit into the analysis?
Well, the relevance of that, Judge Johnson, is, and it was brought up by both parties, and there's a full email, and I think that both parties kind of took some of it out.
Okay.
But it's a present sense impression as to the discrimination conduct. So Ms. Mullis, the appellant in this case, this was contemporaneous. This email was contemporaneous with what she believed was the discriminatory action. Nowhere in this email does she indicate that it was discrimination or that she felt it was discrimination. She may have been offended by it. She may not have liked it. Now, that's the subjective portion in Barr and McCoy. Somebody may be offended by something, but there has to be it has to be tied to substantive law that the person that they believe are being discriminated against actually has some conduct that you can say, yeah, they fired him.
I've got another question, and
sure.
I'm just trying, I'm interrupting you to save time. I'm looking at the declaration of Mercedes Anderson, and she says that she spoke with Mr. Hassan shortly after the incident, and he said that he was upset, but he was not going to do anything about it because he was uncomfortable and feared retaliation. I'm wondering if there's any evidence in the record that the plaintiff, appellant, was aware of that information at the time she made the report. In other words, did Ms. Anderson tell Ms. Mullis about the statements that are referenced in this declaration?
No, there's nothing in the record that Ms. Lewis, Ms. Anderson, talked to Ms. Mullis about what she had discussed with Mr. Hassan. There's nothing in the record. As a matter of fact, on the email portion that you indicated, Judge, the interesting portion of it is the end of the email in which she does say Israel, which is Mr. Hassan, did laugh it off, but I think you should apologize basically to the interviewee and Mr. Hassan. So there was no, and there's nothing in the record that we have that, other than after the lawsuit, we understand that Ms. Anderson and Ms. Mullis have this information. But at the time that the meeting took place between Mr. Ingalls, who was the president of Professional Plating Incorporated, and Ms. Mullis, that was not, there's no record of that at all.
And am I correct in understanding that in the district court there was no, there were no arguments to the effect that Mr. Hassan had suffered a hostile work environment or had racial harassment?
That is correct. There were no arguments that there was any hostile work environment or harassment. As a matter of fact, those issues came up, discrimination and how employees at Professional Plating were treated. And it is in the record that Ms. Mullis stated this is the first time she ever heard anything approaching that would be discrimination or anything that would be inappropriate. Race-wise, religion-wise, hostile work-wise, the environment, as indicated by Ms. Mullis, the appellant herself, had been a great environment work-wise up until the time of this incident in which she felt offended by it. I see my time is almost up.
Can I ask
up.
You one more question?
Sure.
With regard to the objective standard, is that the, you know, whether there were objectively reasonable grounds to believe that there was a conduct that violated the law, is that standard, is that a factual question or a legal question?
It is a... In this
or a mixed question.
If I may finish that the answer to that question.
Yes, thank you.
There is, it can be a factual question, was there an adverse employment action? But when there is no evidence of an adverse employment action, there's no genuine material facts that under the statute that Mr. Hassan had any hiring issues, employment issues, any conditions, anything of that nature. And the district court indicated that the record was not, it was absent of that. And on that basis, there was no genuine issue of material fact to determine that. Thank you.
Thank you. So for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So first, I haven't forgotten your question. I want to get back to that right away. I do have some other things that I'd like to talk about. But you, I think the question, and please correct me if I'm missing any part of it, was what in this context of what happened on that date takes this outside the realm of something minimal or non-material in terms of working conditions? Was that the gist of the question?
Yes.
Okay. And I think... So I think we have talked about that a little bit, and perhaps I've either been unclear or I'm not making sense. You know, and I'll put it in the context of something that counsel just said, you know, in his own discussion of what constitutes an adverse employment action. One example that he used is someone being moved from their desk. And I would submit that, you know, certainly after standing in a room with a fellow colleague who is introduced by her name and job title and then being reduced, you know, to non-personhood, you are this race, you are this religion, I would say that is not material. If you cannot go into your workplace every day and you know, have the respect of being treated like an individual human being, I would think that is material, certainly if moving a desk is material or something that constitutes an adverse action. And stepping back a little further, I think if we're getting into the realm of where we're saying that Ms. Mullis has to plead and then ultimately establish that Mr. Hassan suffered an adverse employment action, that by definition becomes actionable MHRA discrimination on his behalf that imposes an actual violation standard, which the bar court refused to adopt, which this court has never applied. And I think it makes some sense then, and since we're talking about bar and how that came about, to look at what actually the conduct there was that they were considering, right? And so bar came in the context of a Rule 12 motion, and it was only what was in the complaint. And the Supreme Court in its decision made a point of talking about, hey, we're having a tough time figuring out exactly what it is that you, plaintiff, are claiming is discriminatory. And ultimately, it decided that what the plaintiff was claiming was that the university's decision not to put somebody on a performance improvement plan was racially discriminatory. And the court said, of course, as we've discussed, that the nature of the discrimination has to be tied to the substantive elements of the statute. What does it historically prohibit? And it then went on to say nobody could reasonably find that not putting someone on a performance improvement plan is any kind of adverse action. It didn't say you have to prove an adverse action. It just used that, saying you can't find that because it's just not a thing. Similarly, in McCoy, you know, McCoy followed Barr, and McCoy and Barr both predate Delaney, which is cited and discussed in detail in our brief and is a decision from this court, although unpublished, which we believe is on all fours, just substitute the word race for sexual harassment. But in McCoy, the same thing. The court looked at what was the actual, you know, discrimination that was being alleged, and it was two instances. In one case, the plaintiff was saying, my woman colleague was discriminated against because one of her supervisors authored an incorrect performance evaluation of her, and then said he was scared of strong women. The inaccurate performance report never went into her personnel file. It was corrected. She received a glowing report, and so there was nothing in the context of, you know, putting an accurate glowing performance report into somebody's file. That's in no way something that the MHRA on its face prohibits. The other person was, the other report was dealing with a promotion that a woman was given, and the reporter said that was discriminatory against another female, but the court said no, simply promoting a fellow member of the same protected class to an equal position is not in any way something that the MHRA prohibits. And so the factual specifics of those cases are very different than here. And again, it gets back into what we've talked about, and I don't want to beat the dead horse, but just the concept of basic human dignity being a term and condition and privilege of employment. And I think, you know, it's also significant to note that the commissioner of human rights, right, in the Barr case said this: the plain language of section 363A.15 permits a reprisal plaintiff to seek relief without showing that discrimination occurred. The MHRA defines unfair discriminatory practice as reprisal by a person who participated in the alleged discrimination against the person who opposed a practice forbidden by the MHRA. The law only requires an allegation of discrimination to protect a person from reprisal. The MHRA does not require that the conduct forming the basis of the opposition withstand the legal scrutiny of a court of law that would apply in reviewing whether the conduct was actually discriminatory. So the commissioner disagrees, and so with that, my time is up. I would note we also have a timing argument, which we don't mean to waive, but haven't had a chance to discuss. But we would ask that this court reverse the order of the district court and remand the case for trial.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you to counsel for both parties. We appreciate your helpful arguments. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.